Okay, Mike, thanks so much for kicking us off. Like Mike mentioned, we are going to be discussing the question, how could a loving God allow so much suffering? My guess that this is not the first time that you guys have heard that question. Many of you have probably wrestled with that question yourself. Maybe some of you have had friends or family raise that question to you. This question comes in all sorts of different ways and phrases. Sometimes it's something like this. You know, it sure seems like either God is all good, but not all powerful, or all powerful, but not all good. Or maybe this, there's so much suffering in the world, a loving, all-powerful God cannot exist. Sometimes specific examples are pointed to. The Holocaust, the Crusades, COVID, etc. They prove God does not exist. A loving God would never have allowed those things to happen. As we discuss this topic tonight, first, I want to zoom out to talk about how suffering isn't just a problem for Christians. It's something that everyone has to deal with. The problem of suffering is universal, and it affects us all. But we are here to put Christianity under the microscope, not all worldviews and religions. So then we're going to zoom back in to discuss how to unpack suffering and understand it from a Christian perspective. Finally, we'll discuss some of the resources that Christianity has to offer for those who suffer and endure that, the hope for the suffering. So if you're following along, looking at your handout there, the first two points will be a bit more philosophical, and then the last one will be a bit more personal and experiential. So let's start by talking about the problem of suffering, this universal thing. How do people deal with it? Modern scholarship is recognizing an interesting trend that though in America and much of the Western world, individuals and communities empirically enjoy a higher standard of living compared to many around the world, they experience less happiness. Though Westerners go through less suffering, Western culture provides fewer resources to process and endure the hardships that there are well. Westerners, they enjoy resources and a level of safety the rest of the world longs for, and yet depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and drug overdose cases abound. What is happening here? We have to look at how each different view, each different society tries to answer this, because suffering, it comes for us all. In today's postmodern secular culture, here's the typical response to it. Suffering is just a relatively unavoidable part of life. You know, sure, we can try and medicate or avoid or distract, but it's unavoidable. And in a way, this makes sense. This is how things work. This is how we all got here, how mankind evolved, how creatures outcompeted one another and human society came to be was the strong ate the weak. Generation after generation, millennia after millennia, epoch after epoch, the strong ate the weak. There's no good or evil. Your desire for life or peace or order is just a preference or a result of cultural conditioning or maybe just some sort of evolutionary survival tactic. So ultimately, suffering is meaningless. There's no greater purpose to it, and there will be no restoration for it. So according to the postmodern secular view, the life that you long for is destined to be ripped away from you through either sudden tragedy or the slow creep of old age, and there's not a thing that you can do about it. Yuval Noah Harari, he's an author and professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And Harari, who identifies as an atheist, he writes in his book, Homo Deus, The History of Tomorrow, since there is no script, and since humans fulfill no role in any great drama, terrible things might befall us, and no power will come to save us or give meaning to suffering. There won't be a happy ending, or a bad ending, or any ending at all. Things just happen, one after the other. The modern world does not believe in purpose, only in cause. So, to summarize, Harari is saying suffering is unavoidable, and there's no purpose to it. For good reason, many find this worldview deeply unsatisfying. It doesn't give much help or hope. It essentially just says to people suffering, deal with it. As a result, Many find it completely incapable of providing the help or hope they need to survive or somehow thrive in suffering. And so, even people who would identify as secular and non-religious, they many times end up borrowing from other religions and worldviews to try and find the comfort and resources that they need. So one example is that many have tried adding Eastern practices of meditation into their lives. Some have found great help from this. So some people like to be mostly secular, but sprinkle in a little bit of Buddhism or some sort of other Eastern worldview. But a key argument from many of these Eastern worldviews is that you escape suffering by breaking ties of attachment. So the Stoics would say, you know, just learn to let go of your health, your family, anything that you love. Just be ready for it to be ripped away, harden your heart so you don't care if it's gone. But attachment, especially in relationships, is often what gives life meaning. Functionally, most people struggle to actually live that way, where their heart isn't engaged with anyone or anything. No, we want to be tightly connected to friends, to families, to a lover. We desperately long for this sort of connection. So other people, they try out a Western theistic religion, maybe Judaism, maybe Islam. But then, you know, you have to deal with many claims about how you should live. And ultimately, you're still left with this problem. There may be a God who is powerful and kind, but if he is he powerful or kind enough to deal with the suffering we see around us? Okay, well, what about Christianity then? At first glance, Christianity seems to have even more problems than any of those other worldviews that I just mentioned. And that's because it makes even higher claims. Christianity says, in 1 John 4, God is love. Christianity says in the book of Romans, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. Christianity makes some of the highest claims, but the experience of so many in our world does not look like love or goodness. Every day around the world, children die. Every day around the world, the poor are oppressed, even abused. Every day, people are hurting and neglected. Where is God? Where is God as people are dying, are being killed? Does this not show that God must be at best absent or apathetic? On the other side of your handout there, we put a selection from Psalm 73. The psalmist Asaph, he wrestles with some of these questions as he looks at the wickedness in his world, and especially wicked people that seem to be thriving as they're oppressing many around them. And he says, behold, these are the wicked. Always at ease, they increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence, for all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. Here's the point. Every worldview has problems with the issue of suffering. The question is, what answers, what resources does each worldview have to respond to the pressures and complexities of suffering? Like I said, tonight, we're not here to talk about every worldview. We're here to put Christianity under the microscope. Can Christianity bear the weight of this question? So let's unpack suffering from a Christian perspective. So that's point two on your handout, the unpacking of suffering. As we examine the issue of suffering, we find that the case against Christianity, surprisingly, it's not as airtight as it seems. Over the centuries, thousands of philosophers, historians, scientists, and scholars have discovered a wealth of information on the subject. And millions of people throughout history and around the world have found persuasive answers to the question, how could a loving God allow so much suffering? So, as we look at this, let's start with two reasons suffering does not disprove Christianity. I know that's a double negative, but two reasons suffering does not disprove Christianity, and then one reason that it actually makes a strong case for it. So, first is human assumptions. That's a fill-in there for you. Human assumptions. Because most people, they don't have a problem with all suffering, not across the board. You know, when someone totals their car hitting a deer because they were texting while driving, people don't usually get that angry at God when that happens. Or when someone suffers through a nearly overwhelming academic program but comes out the other side with an incredible career, people don't usually blame God for that suffering either. No, rather, what confuses and infuriates people is the seeming frequency of pointless suffering. When someone who worked hard their whole life helping other people in the neighborhood, volunteering in their local homeless shelter, when that person has their retirement savings stolen, when that person is killed in a drunk driving accident, when the suffering seems pointless, that's what gets under people's skin. Most people's real question then is, why does God allow so much pointless suffering in our world? That's when people get mad. That's when people question God. That's when people say, God cannot exist and allow things like that. But even atheist philosophers have pointed out that there's a really dangerous hidden assumption baked in there. Hidden in the argument that pointless suffering denies the existence of God is the belief that if suffering appears pointless to me, it must be. But if God is wise, powerful, all-knowing, could there not be reasons for suffering that we do not see? Just because you can't imagine a good reason for God to allow it doesn't mean there isn't one. The skeptic, they actually have a very strong, perhaps overblown faith in their own faculties of reason and observation. Philosopher Alvin Plantinga, he uses this illustration of St. Bernard's versus no-see-ums. And so he imagines a couple of friends out on a camping trip. And the one friend says to the other, hey, can you look in the tent and just check and see if there are any St. Bernards in there? The friend can very easily duck his head in the tent and say, there's no St. Bernards. But if the friend looks to the other and says, hey, could you duck your head in the tent and see if there's any no-see-ums in there? And no-see-ums are this tiny gnat-like fly called no-see-ums because you can't see them. If the friend ducks his head in the tent and says, no, I don't see any no-see-ums, he can't actually have any confidence in his answer. Friends, in our world today, we often assume that all of the reasons for suffering in our world will be more like St. Bernard's. Very obvious and easy to see. When in actuality, many, many of the reasons for suffering in our world are likely much more like no-see-ums. Where we can look for them, we can try to puzzle them out, but we're just not going to see them. So that's one, human assumption. Here is another reason why suffering does not disprove Christianity. That is human experience. Many people who go through deep and tragic suffering, they later recognize that some good came out of it. Seasons of hardship and suffering prepared and shaped them in ways that they are later thankful for. There's a great example of this in the very first book of the Bible in Genesis, a man named Joseph. Maybe some of you have heard the story before, but for those of you that it's a little bit old or rusty, Joseph was one of 12 brothers, and his mom and dad liked to play favorites. And so sibling rivalry was huge. Joseph didn't help the matter very much, sometimes egging people on. But at the end of the day, what happened was his brothers got so angry with him, so jealous of him, that they decided, you know what? Maybe we should just kill him. And so they grab him and they throw him in a pit. And they're considering getting rid of him, putting him to death. And then they say, oh, well, you know, we're godly people. We shouldn't kill him. We'll just sell him into slavery and make a few bucks. And so Joseph, as a 17-year-old, is sold into slavery by his own family. His brothers make up a lie to his parents, sell him some animal, seems like he killed him. And he goes off, away from all of his family, all of his friends, all hopes for his future, dashed, and he's sold as a slave into this family. And at first things go well because he works really, really hard. He wants to honor God in serving even in the midst of this unjust circumstance. And then the injustices keep on piling up. He's falsely accused of sexual abuse and he's thrown into prison for years. In the prison, he serves even in the midst of unjust circumstances and he's forgotten about. But God gives him this tremendous ability to interpret dreams. And finally, a situation comes up where a dream interpreter is desperately needed. Pharaoh, the ruler of all the land of Egypt, has a dream. It scares him to no end. No one can answer his questions about what this dream means. And finally, someone remembers, hey, there was this guy in prison who could interpret dreams. And they get him. And he interprets that the dream means that there are going to be many years of good produce in the land, followed by a period of 7 years of utter famine. A famine so severe, so dire, that if preparations were not made, everyone in the known world would die. Keep in mind, this is thousands of years ago, before canning, before huge food stockpiles, before globalized trade. A famine ruined everything. Everyone was going to die, but God worked, even in the midst of all this suffering, putting Joseph where he needed to be to save lives. Joseph is suddenly brought out of prison, promoted to number two in charge of all of Egypt under the king, and he gets to work. He collects food, he saves people, and eventually his own family are starting to starve, run out of food. They come to Egypt, and they see, here's the brother that they sold into slavery, in charge, handing out the food. And after some back and forth and interactions where the story ends, his brothers are terrified that Joseph's finally going to get even with them. And Joseph says this, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." Joseph is able to have this amazing perspective where he looks back at all the cruelty, all the injustice, all of the heartbreak, and says, God was bringing good out of that. God was at work here. And so I'm not going to take revenge. I'm trusting that the Lord had a good plan for it. That's a biblical example. Here's a personal one. I almost feel silly sharing this. It's nowhere near as serious as Joseph's. But in high school, I remember feeling incredibly, incredibly insecure. And one of the biggest reasons that I felt insecure was that I had worse acne of anyone I had ever seen. I couldn't find a single person in my school that had acne as bad as mine. And constantly it felt like it was this thing between me and other people, making me feel ashamed, making me feel inadequate. And I was so upset. I pleaded with the Lord saying, get rid of this. Why is this in my life? I don't want this. I desperately longed for a romantic relationship. And it felt like this was the anchor dragging me down to the depths, preventing me from finding love. But now when I look back, this strange thing happens. This thing that I railed against, this thing that I shook my fist at God over, I'm now deeply thankful for. Because when I look back at my past self and I consider how foolish I was, how impulsive I was, how utterly unconcerned I was with the character of the people around me, I think about how easy it would have been for me to make mistakes that would have changed the entire trajectory of my life. I may never have met my wife that I now am so thankful for. I may not have my son that I delight in. So when I look back, I see, okay, the Lord used even this suffering. And friends, if we can see a purpose in suffering some of the time, why can't God have and know a purpose in our sufferings all of the time? So human assumptions and human experience are two reasons that suffering does not disprove Christianity. But there's also one that surprisingly builds a case for it. And that is the recognition of evil. So that's your fill-in, the recognition of evil. You see, if there's no God, if the only reason that we are here is just chance, the collision of particles, evolution, how do we explain the incredibly common, deep sense that certain things are evil? You see, the psalmist here, he's not just angry at suffering, but angry that the wicked often seem to be the ones getting a pass. They seem to be the ones doubling down on the suffering that others are feeling. C.S. Lewis, famous author of the Chronicles of Narnia and many other works, at one point he rejected God because of the cruelty of life. But later, he realized that evil was even more problematic for his new atheistic worldview. He writes in his book, Mere Christianity, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Of course, I could have given up any idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not just simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple." You see what C.S. Lewis is saying? Natural selection depends on death, destruction, violence of strong against the weak. So, if mankind got here through natural selection, where has this human sense of justice and that humans ought not to suffer come from? People who do not have a faith in God or Jesus certainly can be outraged at the injustice and suffering in our world. And I'm deeply thankful that they are. Maybe that's you. I'm thankful. But despite the outrage at injustice, they often have a hard time explaining why they should feel outrage or obligation. Like, why should this be something there based on a purely secular material worldview? What is the basis for that feeling? But Christianity explains those feelings. We feel that things are unjust because we are sensing the realities of justice that God created us to sense. So, as we unpack the issue of suffering, we see that the case against Christianity is not as cut and dry as it first seems. Even atheist philosophers shoot down many of the most common arguments against God from suffering. But maybe you're here tonight and you say, I don't care about all of this philosophical arguing, different principles. I don't care. I'm angry. I don't care about that. I am mad at God for what happened. How could he have allowed this to happen to me and to my family? If that's you, I'm so sorry. I recognize that some of these first two points are cold comfort. What I'd like to do now is talk about how Christianity actually offers hope and comfort for those who are suffering. That's our third point. I want to talk about two ways Christianity gives hope in the face of suffering. The first is that the Bible shows that God himself endured suffering. God endured suffering. In Jesus, God relates to and became subject to human suffering himself. Jesus is the God of the universe, becoming a man, entering into the world he created. And he doesn't just live a normal life. Jesus conducts himself in a life and a ministry where he's constantly being mistreated, neglected, and ultimately subjected to one of the most gruesome executions the world had thought of. And as we look at Jesus, as he gets closer and closer to his end, to the Roman cross that he will die upon, we see that he does not face it with composure. He's deeply troubled. He's sweating blood, likely experiencing shock. Why wasn't Jesus more courageous, less anxious? He's God, after all. He knows what's coming next. Why is he so, so incredibly anxious? It's because the greatest agony is the loss of relationship that you desperately want or that is precious to you. Let me give you an example. Let's say after this tonight, one of you come up to me and you say, "Kevin, you're an idiot. That was the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Everything you say, in fact, is dumb. And I never want to hear another word out of your mouth or see you again." I will be hurt, but I will get over it. But let's say I go home tonight I start talking with my wife and sharing about what I did today. And my wife turns to me and says, "Kevin, you're an idiot. Everything you say is dumb. I don't want to hear another word out of your mouth, and I never want to see you again." I'll be devastated. I'll fall to pieces. Why? What is making the difference between those two things? The difference is that in one of those two, my relationship is so much more close, so much more intimate, so much more central to my identity, my delights, who I am. And so the thought of losing it is heartbreaking. Friends, Jesus, for all eternity, has enjoyed a relationship with God the Father we could not dream of. God the Son and God the Father have delighted in one another, shared with one another, honored one another for all eternity. A relationship stronger and more wonderful than the greatest marriage we could imagine times a million. And on the cross, Jesus is losing it. That's what Jesus gave up. He is being forsaken, rejected. That relationship of incredible love is being cut off. This is the hell that Jesus endured for his people. This is why on the cross, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus was not just disconnected from a loving relationship. He was disconnected from the one who is the source and inventors of all love and relationships. So Jesus did not just endure suffering. He endured the greatest suffering imaginable. And this is where Christianity does something utterly unique. Where Christianity has something that no other religion or worldview does. First, it tells us what the answer to the question that we've been asking tonight is not. So how could a loving God allow so much suffering? This shows us that the answer is not that God doesn't care. That God doesn't empathize. God cared so much that he came and shared your sufferings. Jesus went through hell to rescue you. No other religion has a God so willing to endure suffering for you, to enter into your sufferings. And if Jesus loved you enough to take the biggest suffering for you, surely there's a reason for the smaller sufferings. So first, it tells us what the answer to the question is not. Second, it shows us one of the many mysterious reasons God allows suffering. And there are many. I've read books that list upwards of 20, 30 different reasons. But here's one that's kind of being hinted here. Let's back up a moment. Suffering, if you think about it, it often feels dehumanizing. Like you're becoming less and less of a person. Like you're being torn away from all you love. You feel more and more alone, more and more disconnected. You feel less and less human. But what if our sufferings didn't disconnect us, but reconnected us? Those with similar trauma backgrounds often form strong ties of attachment. Fellow sufferers can relate to and love one another in ways others can't. No one else understands how hard that was, how hard this is, but they do. Friends, Jesus embraced suffering so he could have that with us. So we can have more in common with and more connection with Jesus. So how and why could a loving God allow suffering? One reason out of many is to draw people close to Jesus. This is not the only reason, but it is a powerful one, because Jesus is God made flesh, the source of life and love and laughter. And so being connected to Jesus is being connected to the source of all love, all joy. So being closer to Jesus is worth any cost. This is why in the book of 1 Peter in the Bible, 1 Peter 4:13 says, "But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed." So, in Jesus, God endured suffering. But he did far more than that. God also defeated suffering. God defeated suffering. In Jesus, God's suffering reverses the power of evil and suffering forever. Jesus' suffering on the cross, it marked the beginning of the end for earthly suffering. Because Jesus suffered in our place, suffering's days are numbered. Our sufferings here, they are tragic. They are heartbreaking. They are worthy of lamenting. We weep, we mourn, but if we trust in Jesus, we can also sing with joy because we know that they are temporary. And we know that Jesus saved us from far greater, unending, eternal sufferings. God's plan for suffering is to ultimately defeat suffering. You know, everyone longs to know that when they've been through hard suffering, that it had a purpose, that it means something, that it was used. This is why when a family member dies due to a drunk driving accident, often the family members, they join Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They devote themselves to ending it. Or when a family member passes away from cancer, often people do walks for cancer research. Survivors often commit themselves to fighting against that in the future. Friends, don't you see that this longing that we have is there for a reason? We know that suffering should not be purposeless. And the Bible agrees. The biblical view is resurrection, not consolation only, but restoration, that there will actually be a time where everything is made right. Everything is made new. New heavens, new earth. Horrible things are not just repaired, but somehow the enjoyment of glory is made even greater, better than if we had never experienced suffering at all. So in many worldviews, suffering is pointless. There is no meaning. There is no ultimate purpose to life. It just happens, and you have to deal with it. But in Christianity, suffering leads to hope and joy. It leads people going through the worst of circumstances to experience what the psalmist says in verse 26. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. And these are no theoretical resources. These are proven ones. There's a woman that my wife and I have enjoyed listening to, reading much of what she's written. Her name is Joni Erickson Tada. At the age of 17, she had a diving accident where she became a quadriplegic, paralyzed from the neck down, stuck in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. And as if that wasn't bad enough, over the following decades, she endured multiple bouts of cancer and painful cancer treatments. And in that time, she pressed close to the Lord. She tried to say, okay, this is horrible suffering. I have lost so much. This isn't a theoretical, philosophical question for me. Can the promises of God actually hold up to this? And she found that they can. She writes in her book, When God Weeps, I'd rather be in this wheelchair knowing God than on my feet without him. She has proved that faith in God can bear the weight of suffering. It won't buckle. When she first had her accident, she struggled. She wrestled. Like verse 21 says, when my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast towards you. She's been there. She's felt that. So angry at God that she wants to snap at him like an animal. But something happened that let her go from beast to belief, from embittered to encouraged. How did she do that? Verses 16 and 17 show us how. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to be a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned their end. Joni Erickson Tada, in the midst of her suffering, it felt so hard, so weary. She's already overwhelmed by the pain and the suffering she's going through. But even in the midst of that weariness, that stress, she drew near to the Lord. She came near to the place where people gathered to worship God, to learn about God, to hear from him in his word. The place then was called the sanctuary of God. Today we might call it church or Christian community. And that's what Joni did. And as she drew near to God and to other believers in the church, she experienced the joy, the comfort, and the encouragement of God. And she knows that this is just a taste of what to come for, what will come for all eternity. C.S. Lewis, in another one of his books, The Great Divorce, he says, "They say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it. Not knowing that heaven, once attained, will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory." So, why does a loving God allow suffering? Because God knows and works to make sure of something, that followers of Jesus, for them, present sufferings will only ever increase future joy. So, as we wrap up here, suffering does not disprove Christianity. In fact, it becomes an even bigger problem for people that have a worldview without any God in it. There's no resources then to process through the pain of suffering. And Christianity actually offers great hope and resources for those who endure suffering. Christianity is the only religion with a God who actually suffers, a God who can relate with our pain. We may not know exactly what the answer for suffering is, but we do know what it isn't. That God, it is not that God doesn't love us. The cross proves that he does. This is why Romans 8:28 says, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose." I'll end with just one last quote by Tim Keller in his book, The Reason for God. He writes, "So if we embrace the Christian teaching that Jesus is God and that he went to the cross, then we have deep consolation and strength to face the brutal realities of life on earth. We can know that God is truly Emmanuel, God with us, even in our worst sufferings." Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for not leaving us in the midst of this broken world with suffering and trials to our own devices. Thank you for your willingness to enter in, to come and to share in our sufferings and ultimately to rescue us from them. I pray, Lord, that if there are people here that this is not just a question, a philosophical subject for them, that you would meet them in the midst of their pain, that you would show them your love, your compassion, your mercy, and your comfort. Bless the rest of our time together tonight. And in your name, amen.